Electronic voting, kind of a recap of what's going on, is since these machines were installed in our state in 2002, we were the first state to go statewide all electronic voting, and there's absolutely no evidence provided by any of these machines. It's a joy. My name is Aaron Rossetta. I represent a little org called papercounts.org. I'm also currently working on a Secretary of State's campaign, a statewide race, and helping lead that effort. For a candidate who is going to work to improve the voting situation in our state. I'm here with Chris Huffines.
Huffines,
okay.
And I'm an evil lawyer at a local firm in here called Casey Gilson. I'm a trial attorney, and I specialize in a bunch of different stuff, but including IP and franchising issues. So.
Right. And that actually comes into play because of the way the voting machine systems were installed in the state, and also because one of the things that we've got underway to try and correct the problem of zero evidence electronic vote fraud in our state is we've got a lawsuit going, and is currently before the Georgia Supreme Court. They've heard the arguments, and we're waiting for a result from them. It's going to hinge on a couple of critical issues, and you've been studying the case, so Chris is going to speak to that a little bit later. I'm going to start off by talking about what makes a good voting system, or what is, in fact, the gold standard for a voting system. Do just a simple, fun exercise here, and that's that I'm going to demonstrate the traditional steps to go into a voting process. I'm doing this because everybody says, oh, well, you know, I know how to fix those voting machines. You just use cryptography and you just do this and that and you just complicate everything with computers and that's going to solve the problem. And that's fine to come up with those ideas, and we certainly want that pool of ideas out there of a better way to vote. But it's very difficult to improve on a very simple, basic system of voting on paper ballots with a solid chain of custody, which is one of the main issues in the whole voting process. There's two. The other big issue is anonymous balloting. Basically, it's called the Australian balloting system, where you don't know who cast any particular piece of paper or who cast any particular ballot. Because of that, I think it's my opinion that the electronic voting machines are extremely inappropriate for voting systems. Because protecting that anonymity makes that transaction different than any other kind of transaction. It's not like when I go up to a gasoline pump and put in my credit card and get a receipt. I have a record of that transaction that I can take and prove whether or not, you know, if there's a challenge on the amount of the transaction or something like that, I've got a piece of proof. I can't walk away from the voting system with a receipt. There are no receipts in voting. And it's actually a little bit of wording that the opposition has used to kind of taint the issue and confuse the issue. Well, we'll give people a receipt. No, you can't give people a receipt, you know. Well, we'll print out a receipt. No, there's no receipts in voting, but they use that language to confuse the issue. There are paper audit trails. Some of the systems in use produce paper audit trails. I see difficulties in that too, and we'll talk about that as we get a comparison of the electronic systems to the traditional voting system. Traditional voting system, you vote on a piece of paper. Person comes into the precinct, are you a registered voter?
Yeah.
Oh, there's your ballot. Okay, you're on the registered voter list, they know you're a citizen, you may have to show proof of ID.
This is Georgia, you have to show proof of ID, but...
Yeah, you do. You've always had to show proof of ID, they just restricted it to fewer forms of ID with the current administration. So the rest of you want to come up and get a ballot, and I can offer a high-tech computer for marking your ballot. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the new voting computer 2000. Yes. Got a pen. Yes, here we go. You got one, okay. He's got his own computer with him, you know, he can take his laptop and do it. All right. So you go ahead and you fill out your ballot. And then you... Right. Well, that's the next step. That's the next step. The first... Hey, you got it, okay. Hey. Oh, you got it. Okay. Unfortunately, all the systems that we use in this state are running Windows ME. they're running a customized version of Windows ME, which is one of the reasons they get one of the ways they get around any certification issues. The certification is totally bogus too, because it's all done by private companies and nobody can actually look at the results of the certification or see how the systems were certified. So there's no certification in effect. It goes on, but I'm sidetracking from our basic demonstration. Okay, who wants to vote first here? Who wants to be the first voter in the precinct in the morning here? It's 7 a.m. All right, you got your ballot ready?
I got my
ballot. Okay, so next step is we take this. Hello, are we on?
You can't back.
Okay, right. Okay, next step is we go ahead with the first voter and we say, is the ballot box empty, sir?
Yes, it is.
Would you sign this little receipt to say so?
Okay.
All right, okay, so we sign a little receipt. He says, the ballot box is empty. Close the ballot box. We lock it up, ideally with a couple of different locks. And so you got like two people with keys to the box. So we got a black twist tie and a white twist tie.
One from each of the two major parties.
One from each of the, ignoring all others, one from each of the two major parties, exactly. No, these would be locks with keys. Okay, but the idea is that you've got the ballot box; it's in public view at the whole time. Thanks.
In Chicago, they used regular.
Yeah. All right. You've certified the ballot box is empty. You can place your ballot in the box. Okay. Right. Exactly. That was Stalin. Yeah. It's not. It's. Daley may have followed up with that. Stalin was it's not who vote that counts, it's who counts the vote. All right. So everybody else is welcome to come up to the ballot box now, and of course the ballot box is in full public view while we're doing all this. You've still voted privately and anonymously. Right? I don't know whose ballot is which isn't here. There's no markings on the ballot to say. Oh, well, yeah, okay. We're stretching it a little bit, but that's to get you on our mailing list, so yeah. That's the marketing side. Normally, there, of course, would be no identification at all on the ballots. Everybody's voted? So the clock ticks away, it's the end of the polling day. We're here at the precinct. The ballot box has never left our site. It's in full public view and guarded. Our two people with keys come up. Here, you're one of the people with keys. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And we take the ballots out and we count them. Make sure the number of ballots matches the number of voters, and hopefully there's no errors there. But track out the total count of ballots. And then we can take these out and individually count them with all concerned parties there to see the process and count them by hand in full public view. So do you mind doing a tally for me while we're going on? All right.
I think everybody got to check the box.
That's an undervote,
but that is an issue, and it's one of the things that computers are actually good at solving. I mean, we're not Luddites here, okay? So this is the traditional process. If you're doing this right, this box is opened and the ballots are counted, you know, by hand, by human beings in the precinct. This is the way it's done in most legitimate democracies around the world still, whether it's Germany or Spain or Ireland. All the concerned parties, Germany, you got like, you know, a table of like 15 people sitting around trying to count the ballots, because they got, you know, several major parties out there with interest in the results.
And a key thing being witnessed by opposing parties.
Exactly. It's witnessed by everybody who has a stake in the election. So it's not hidden from public view at any point. And that's pretty much the ideal, basic, simple electing process. Everybody follow that? Would everybody agree that this is hard to improve on? As long as you keep the anonymous vote principle, it's hard to improve on that. And as long as you keep the anonymous vote principle, it's hard to do another system. And there are people who are arguing that we should do away with anonymous balloting.
That would be the only way to get voting receipts. Say, you can publish, you know, what I voted on, but I get a receipt, and that way you have a chain of custody.
The problem with that kind of receipt, with being able to tell anyone else what your vote was, is that's what enables vote buying and voter intimidation. That was actually a classic Tammany politics.
But that's why you have the option not to have the next
Yeah, but if the kneecappers come in and say, you make it public or else.
Well, I understand, but here's the thing. Where is your right to tell me I can't have voter security on my vote? Where is your right to your voter privacy? My right to voter security.
I think it would be that the public's right to have a free, fair election that is not affected by outside forces does trump an individual right to chain of custody in that case.
Right.
You're trying to actually sell me that that's actually what happened. You're not telling me there's not outside forces pressuring.
No, I'm not saying there's not, but
I understand that. But where does the my question is, where does the fundamental right of the majority outweigh my right to voter security?
Well, where is your right to voter security gone in this system? It's a public system where everybody.
I can't track the proof that you the account was made public. I see what you're saying.
Yes, we can, because we've got the paper evidence right here.
But
that's
he
really
can't
a point
track
of this.
His yellow piece of paper is one of the ones being held right there.
I actually have an answer to that question, which Aaron pointed out to me one time. You, as an individual, can actually volunteer to be the person that verifies the votes in your precinct.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, that's one way that you can do that. And there's nothing to stop you from volunteering to be a witness to the counting process when it's done, when it's handled properly. The idea here is you're not really giving up security because there's public eyes on the process the entire time.
I think another thing that's important here is we're dealing with a situation where there are two conflicting interests, and you know, no one's going to be 100% happy because there's got to be a compromise. And your ability to track your vote from your pen to, in the presidential case, to the electors, that's got to at some point give way to the other concerns. And where that point is, obviously there's room for disagreement.
Okay, so I believe our tally is actually already done, because they'll always tell you that it takes forever to count all those paper ballots. And it does take some time. It's not an easy process. But in any one precinct, if you're counting them at the precinct level, in Georgia, the most you can have is 1,000 voters in any one precinct. So in any one precinct, we've got maybe 1,000 votes to count. Even if there's 20 races, if you've got a stack of 10 people, plowing through the process, you can manually count an election probably by the time they drive the cards to the central office to have them tabulated. So
the question I would have is, obviously, there were issues in the 2000 election with the polling chads and that that led this push to electronic voting.
Right.
Allegedly it was going to be a more efficient, better way of doing democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So where are we?
It's certainly a more expensive one. It costs five times as much to run an election now as it does.
Right.
Where
are we? How do we
Well, it's mostly the big media that was pushing for the speed on the elections. And when you look back to the history of, NASED, National Association of State Election Directors. Okay, this was like a private club that was set up by the voting machine company vendors for the state election officials to sell them and propagandize them about the election systems. It was formed in about 1990. And a lot of the election systems that we have now came out of that. This little NASED group was actually formed, supposedly, to address the issue that the media was complaining they didn't get results fast enough. Because it's all about how fast you get the results, not whether or not the results are accurate in an election, correct?
Well, in fairness, the speed of results does impart a feeling in the general populace that the election was fair. If it takes longer, somebody starts wondering what hinky stuff is going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's the equivalent of security theater.
Yeah.
But it does have an effect.
My question would be, what's the empirical truth really behind? How many times have we really?
Well, again, most of the legitimate elections around the world conduct their elections this way, and they have the results the next day.
And it's
accurate, and it's and it's complete. Yeah, so it's whether or not, you can have faux news call the election, George's cousin call the election at 3:00 in the morning on faux news, or whether you actually have to wait until 9:00 the next morning for the actual results to come in so you can say, oh, we've got all the totals now so we know actually who won. Yeah, exactly. Also, the hanging chad issues and stuff with the voting systems in Florida, there's been some reports that even the making of the cards may have been intentionally fouled up. Also, you've got to remember that these are the same voting machine companies that make the electronic machines. So they wanted to sell all new machines to these people, so what better way than to make sure the old ones fouled up? Since they were in charge of all the materials from the beginning to the end, like Diebold not only handles all the electronic voting systems in our state, they also are in charge of printing the ballots, all the absentee ballots and things like that. So you got this monopoly over the situation. They control the whole voting process from top to bottom. And so when they do that, then you get into issues. Punch cards can be done well and done accurately. The machines they used in California, for instance, were very simple and very effective and didn't run into problems. And when there was a challenge to the vote, you could actually recount them because you had paper evidence. Most of the flurry you saw that about problems with the punch card systems was, you know, purely bravado and very much trumped up, I think.
With Diebold getting out of the voting machine system,
mm-hmm.
what do you think the future is for competition?
Less, because Diebold is one of three competitors, and they're selling out to one of the two other competitors that are out there. Yes, ES&S is one of the other two major companies that is involved in electronic voting systems or voting systems in general. It's very difficult to break in because all three of those companies have been making machines back into the punch card days when they first started to do some computerized tabulation and things like that. All three of those companies were part of NACED, and they're firmly entrenched and embedded in our political system through that National Association of State Election Directors Club.
But to the point that they lose credibility, which could happen simultaneously if there's a serious foul-up, new blood may be the only politically acceptable option.
And of course, the actual chances of proving a foul-up are almost nil, because there's absolutely no evidence when you do this with computers. When you do this with computers, especially when you do this with computers that don't produce an audit trail. I'm going to invite John Fortune to come up and join us. John Fortune is head of a group called Defenders of Democracy. He and I have been working this issue for a long time.
Nice.
If you want to come up and sit next to Chris here and grab a microphone, we'll be good. He'll have some input on some thoughts to share with us as well. We weren't sure if he was going to be able to make it, so that's why he didn't make it on the bill. But he can have some other things. So far, we've just done the basic paper election demonstration, and then we're about to talk about what goes on with the election process is different when you do it with computers. So you come in and you do a computer election in our state, did you?
There's one thing that has come up repeatedly. I've been with Aaron at other events, and it comes up repeatedly, is they think that it's a very... If you found out what the people who are yelling and screaming the loudest, their political affiliation, it would look like that it's politically motivated that one party doesn't like the new voting machines. That could be further from the truth than you could possibly get. The fact is, there's people like myself and Aaron, we're about as diametrically opposed politically as you could possibly get, and we both 100% agree on it. And if you poll an audience that comes to one of these presentations, you'll find that's virtually true at every presentation.
Actually, we've polled an audience, so what's the results of our election here?
Well, we've got six that want tangible paper ballots.
Mm-hmm.
We've got two that voted for the invisible computer cab.
Okay.
We've got one undervote. Nobody voted for
that.
And two disputed.
Yeah. As to what the markings were. Okay.
So
the disputed votes go to a panel of judges. We'll say this is our panel of judges. We've got a Republican and a Democrat here, right? And you two can decide which way those were voted and circle the right one.
Let's use colored pens.
Okay,
make it all nice and proper.
Mm-hmm. Be very official indeed. So, right.
I just like red.
Red and blue, thank you.
All right, here you go.
All right. The difference when you're going in to do it with an electronic machine is pretty obvious. Basically, what you do is you walk up to that electronic touchscreen machine. In Georgia, that means there's not even a paper audit trail. And you go ahead and you hand a little plastic card, which is your ballot, basically. All that card is an indicator of which ballot to call up in memory. So you're not even sure that you're getting the ballot that everybody else is, in honesty. You don't know if you're getting the ballot next door to you, the same ballot. You know, It's helpful because you can, if you only speak Spanish, you know, and you're an American citizen who only speaks Spanish, then you can put in your card and it'll call up a Spanish ballot for you if you want.
Actually, arguably that's a good idea. Statistics have shown that on surveys, for example, the first entry will get more than subsequent entries. So on the lower races, you know, judges and, you know, dog walking commissioners and stuff, flipping them randomly 50% probably will get you a more true response than what the current system is, which is the party in power is first.
Or the incumbent is first, I believe, is the list.
Not actually with the Diebold system. With the Diebold system, the Republican is always first.
Oh, okay.
Always. It's programmed in.
It's programmed in. The Republican's always first.
Hard-coded.
And that's just wrong. Exactly. It's just one of the places where it's just wrong. But that means it's also the case with the printed ballots, too.
Actually, it's probably the least offensive technical thing
about the whole system. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So you walk up to, so you get your little ballot indicator card, which is a plastic card they hand you that you turn back in afterwards, and it calls up the ballot on the screen for you. You go ahead and vote your ticket, and you say you're done. It gives you the confirmation page. Yes, that's what it is. And then that leaves the screen. That image leaves the screen. It goes into computer memory. And of course, once it's going into computer memory, everything that you've done is being processed by hundreds of software engineers behind the scenes that you've never seen that can, in fact, and in fact are in many cases, foreign nationals, not even legitimate U.S. citizens, and who may have a vested interest in swinging an election. I don't know why. And so you basically have to whisper in somebody's ear,
hey, Mr. Software Programmer, I voted for B.
Okay, and you got to trust that software programmer to deliver your vote. Okay, yeah, you can put an audit trail on it, and the paper audit trails out there are their own little nightmare in themselves because of the way they've been designed by the voting machine companies, who want to make it as difficult as possible, just because it protects their interests, as difficult as possible to validate and verify that the systems are working correctly. So they give you a little tiny plastic screen with a rolled up piece of paper inside that scrolls by. So you've got the paper audit trail. Now you've got two different and possibly conflicting reports of the vote. Before we just had the one. We just had the one paper record, the one piece of evidence. Now we've got an audit trail and the electronic count. And those two have to line up. So now you approve your ballot by checking and making sure, supposedly, that you do this. When we, Nevada was the second state to go all electronic, and they put the printed ballot audit trail on it, the paper ballot audit trail. it turned out that only about 1 in 10 voters actually bothered to look at the thing, and it only turned out that about 1 in 20 of the precinct registrars actually followed the procedures of that they were supposed to do for the minimal kind of auditing that was supposed to go on with those paper rolls. And then when they actually went to audit the paper rolls, the voting machine companies got together and made the process so cumbersome that it took days and days to audit it. Not because it was hard to count paper ballots or paper rolls, but because they said to actually count any paper roll off the machine, you had to unroll the entire roll through a 300-foot room so you could all see all the votes at the same time. So you go ahead and audit it. So in other words, they set up the procedures for auditing to make it so cumbersome and awkward that it was literally, you know, just impossible to really audit the election. So, I mean, audit trails are not the answer. What we need is we need paper ballots. And that's my opinion. And
do you want to move on to the case?
And yeah, let's move on to the case and let Chris talk for a while.
I think this is actually a really good segue because if you've been paying attention, a lot of what Aaron's been talking about has involved just a lot of assumptions of bad faith or bad acts on the part of the Diebold company.
I'll take exception to that. I am not saying that there are bad faith or bad acts on the part of the Diebold company. I'm saying that as a corporation, their interests are to protect their profits. And the way they do that is by using proprietary software so they can monopolize the system so that they exclude all competition. It's just normal corporate behavior is all it is. I'm not saying there's something conspiratorial about it at all.
Okay. Well, then let's say that they don't do the job right. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah.
They do the job right by their stockholders. Well, no, but I mean they don't. Yeah, they don't do the correct job as far as accurately tallying a vote. The problem being that that's a really tough assumption to run past the courts, and that's been the biggest problem the lawsuit has had recently. Mm-hmm. Long story short, a number of voters, what's the guy's name, Garland?
Garland Favorito.
Yeah, Garland Favorito.
Head of Voter GA. Yeah. VoterGA.org is the group putting together lawsuit.
He's the lead plaintiff if you want to try to track this online. Go to the Supreme Court website, put in Favorito. You should find at least a summary of the case. Georgia. And Georgia is the correct forum because the United States Constitution puts regulation of voting systems as a state function. So you have to go up to the state court first. And the argument essentially is that because there's no audit trail and because there is the risk of programming error, that there is no way to tell that your vote actually went the way you wanted it to in the machine, and therefore the machines violate due process and equal protection. That has not been a successful argument at the district court level, actually the superior court level in the state. Essentially, the court held initially that there's a standing issue. Standing is whether or not you are in fact authorized to come before the court on this issue. It's called the actual case and controversy requirement. You're not allowed to bring a hypothetical problem. It's called an advisory opinion. You can't do that. Because there is just no proof one way or the other, and because the argument relies on the assumption that these people did not do their job the way that they said they would, it's held to be a hypothetical and not an actual case or controversy. There's some other points in there that I think could be argued one way or the other, but the standing issue is a killer. Yes, sir.
So they're not looking at all at the technical side yet. They're just looking at whether you are even allowed to bring the suit.
Right. That is the first hurdle you have to get through is jurisdiction and standing and stuff like that. Yeah, there is. You have to have some actual evidence of something actually going wrong, which it has to have harmed the plaintiff in this case. And in this case, if there, that's another issue, which will come to in a second. Actually, we'll come to it now. The other problem is you have to be standing. You have to be the plaintiff. You have to be the person who was harmed. There's no proof that Favorito or the other plaintiffs actually were harmed and their votes were removed from where they should have been. There's some wiggle room on that one. A lot of times you can say on issues where you know it's going to happen that I'm bringing it as a concerned public citizen, and you can slide in sometimes. But the hypothetical combined with no actual harm really hurt the case.
Yeah, let's clarify, no proof of actual harm.
So it's gone to the Georgia Supreme Court. The Secretary of State is defending the case. The Secretary of State's brief is pretty much what you'd expect. No standing, no proof, no actual plaintiff. And the plaintiffs, and this now calling the appellant, but I'll say plaintiffs, brief is pretty much a rehash of their former brief as far as the issues being raised. It doesn't seem like they didn't really address the standing issue that I saw. I did only skim it because I ran out of time.
Mm-hmm.
So that would worry me the most if I were the plaintiff, is that the thing you really got nailed on at the district court level, you didn't really address in your Supreme Court brief. You're just going to get hammered again on the same issue. So that's kind of where the case is on that point.
There was also some mention, or John may recall this too, because he was at the both the court hearings, I believe. Did you make a Supreme Court hearing?
I missed the Supreme Court hearing.
Okay, you did too. Okay, yeah. The point came down, or the concerns of the defense attorneys were more a matter of whether or not the voting issues in this case, because this is actually also some challenges to Georgia statute and the Georgia Constitution, which we believe actually calls for physical evidence of a paper ballot, and is being argued as part of that case. But whether or not this case or this voting issue comes under the strict scrutiny rules that come along. Do you know about the strict scrutiny stuff?
Chris, do you?
Oh, yes, I do. Sorry, I'll take John. Yeah, that is, I think, another weakness in the plaintiff's case. Specifically, this is going to be an info dump on legal issues, and I apologize to every one of you who falls asleep. There are certain rights that we all have as citizens. The Bill of Rights, as well as some other ones that have been penumbral or included in, like voting. Fundamental rights, when the government in some way restricts a fundamental right, it has to usually survive what's called strict scrutiny test. Strict scrutiny is that first, the reason that the government is in fact restricting the right has to be for a compelling government interest. So for example, in an eminent domain case where you're seizing someone's property, violating their Fifth Amendment, arguably, then you have to have a compelling government interest. You have to put a military base there. Military is a government interest. It has to be a Superfund site. EPA has kind of gotten itself up into compelling government interest. And then the government, having proven that it really, really does need to do this, and it's a big deal, it's a compelling government interest, then has to show that we're not talking about eminent domain and Kelo. Once the government's proven that it's a compelling government interest, they didn't have to prove that they're using the least restrictive method possible. Now, generally, that's not 100% accurate. They can say, well, there's a slightly less restrictive method, but it's really inefficient. This one's better. And they'll get a little bit of wiggle room right there, but not a whole lot. But you have to be infringing on a right in the first place. And the plaintiff has to prove that the right's being infringed on. The example I was coming up with today was, so it's maybe kind of wacky, is if the government says you may not own a gun, Second Amendment right, obviously infringing, says you may not own a gun manufactured in Germany. You may not own a gun that has a caliber that's metric, no 9mm, go good old American calibers. That's not infringing on the right. It does limit your options, but it's not infringing on the right. And so the caliber, the metric issue, would be rational basis scrutiny. Government has to have a good reason for doing it. We'll defer to government at that point. You cannot own a gun at all. That's strict scrutiny. The plaintiffs here are saying that because the insecurity of the voting system is so high that your fundamental right to a vote is being infringed. The government, as defense, and the judge has more or less agreed with, is saying that this is just how the vote's being counted. It's not stopping you from actually casting your vote, and you can always just do an absentee ballot for no reason at all. Georgia has free absentee ballots for anyone who wants to.
That's so, one. Of the, yeah. That's,
yeah.
That's
so therefore,
big changes.
That's a long sentence too. The plaintiffs are saying that this is such insecurity inherent in the system that the fundamental right to vote is being abridged. Therefore, strict scrutiny is the standard. The government as defendant, and then at least the superior court judge. I'm using superior court and district court interchangeably. The trial court level is what it is. They have argued, and then the judge agreed, that this is just a question of the process. It does not necessarily infringe on the right to vote. You can cast your ballot. You can cast a paper ballot if you really want to, because of absentee ballot for no reason. Therefore.
Michael Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah,
and so therefore it's not an infringement on the right, and therefore rational basis is the correct standard, and that is one of the things being appealed. Yeah.
Yeah, Dave. I think so, but I mean there's no telling. This is very. I think. Would you agree, Chris, that this is kind of a lot of this is very gray area? On the issues here?
I think it's grayer because of the technical issues. I do think a better appreciation of the technical issues and a younger judge, may have gone the other way. My initial read I ended up reading the plaintiff's summary judgment motion and the defendant's, and my initial read on the plaintiff's was, you've got a huge standing issue. And then that came out as the decision. Strict scrutiny, it's really wiggly. Voting rights is kind of muddled right now because the Civil Rights Act and the Civil Rights Movement did a lot of good things, but in a kind of a sloppy way legally. So and then there were the responses to that by the government, and they were beaten up again, and again, was kind of sloppy. So the issue is kind of gray because the law is a little muddled. The interesting question is, there are a number of cases which basically do say if you formally went and voted. Let me give you the facts. I think it's a Texas case where the Democratic primary was the only election that really counted because it was the Solid South Democrats. So the election that was Republican versus Democrat was free and open, no problems. The primary for the Democratic Party, which really decided the election as a practical matter, was whites-only Democrat Party members. And that was held to be a violation of the right to vote because you didn't have an effective vote. That's what's going to, I think, decide the case, is whether your vote is effective or not. But that is legally, that kind of sets my teeth on edge because it fixes the problem, but it's not entirely theoretically sound.
That also means that the judge has to understand the technical issue.
Yeah, and what will probably happen is, this is going to be a battle of analogies. We've talked about this in other panels, where if you can say this is like the primary case, then it's called the white primary case, actually, then it'll go one way. If you can win the war of analogies, the other direction, this is just a vote like any other. Or, and you go ahead and shoot me down if I keep going.
Okay.
The other issue that we haven't really touched on is that the other big problem with this case, I think, is that the Secretary of State may have made a bad decision to institute this policy. The question is it an illegal decision? Because she can point to some good reasons to go to electronic voting machines. The fact that there's less ambiguity in whether or not you actually meant to vote for somebody. The speed can be an issue. The fact the language issue is a big deal. They're talking about California. You have 80-something languages. You normally have to print enough ballots to all the polling places to catch everybody who should show up. And if you guess wrong, then you have to wait and print for ballots, or somebody doesn't get to vote. And the electronic machines allow a lot more flexibility and a lot more service, but you're trading that for
evidence.
Increased insecurity. Yeah.
You've got no physical evidence of the individual's vote as it stands. You haven't got a single source for it. Even with the audit trails, you don't have a single source.
But
piece of evidence.
Oh, go ahead, John. Sorry.
Even if you're talking about seeming convenience of having multiple languages appear on the ballots, the actual costs of testing the machines for every election is actually enormous, and this has been completely hidden, but it is a cost that's passed on to, in this state, the counties. And you can look at a paper ballot and pretty quickly determine that it's printed correctly. However, the amount of testing that is supposed to occur prior to those machines being released on voting day is enormous, and
it's not transparent.
It's done by professionals from the Diebold Corporation or their
minions,
their subcontractors.
Yeah.
And if you're weighing the costs of those paper ballots versus the cost of all the testing and all the other issues, it does not balance out. I do not know the answer to that.
No.
What's the situation with on-site printing of ballots? Or like in cases like in California, you may have long ballot initiatives that are actually laws that are being considered public. Just the name is one.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, the
In this type of system?
Well, I mean, this is the absentee ballot that was sent out for the 2008 election, and it's 6 pages. It was on 3 double-sided cards, okay? Because it's one of the issues that you got to try and address with these systems. But they make paper ballots to do that, and you can vote your paper ballot. The process for efficiency Generally, there's a couple of breaks in the chain, as it's done right now, even with paper ballots. And that's that the ballot box, instead of being opened and counted in the precinct, is put in somebody's trunk and goes off.
Somebody in Minnesota found 300 absentee ballots for the Coleman-Franken election.
Right. Somebody found several thousand ballots in Georgia that were in a trunk and buried in a car in a river. So, you know, 2000. Yeah.
Wait, is that like related to the ballot, or did someone just randomly end up in a river?
No. They were the car was found with a trunk full of ballots from the 2000 election.
They were all for Nader.
Yeah. Sure. That's certainly a possible solution to dealing with that and bringing some of that computer some of those computer advantages. I mean, again, we're not Luddites here. There could be advantages, and there are advantages that are notable, like the undervote and the overvote kind of system. So you could basically, if you had the computer, print a paper ballot, then every voter can verify whether or not the computer's working with every vote, basically, right? And that you could do it in multiple languages. It's not a complication there, right? And that voter takes that single record, and that is becomes the ballot of record, and puts it in a ballot box, and that's the ballot that gets counted later. Then, you know, you've got the best of both worlds, and you're not totally dependent on that technology, because you can replace it at any time with a 3-cent pen.
By the way, with regards to California's initiatives, there's a rule that they have to be of a very limited length, so that does cut down the paper.
There's a very limited open source effort underway. We're hoping to improve that. One of the things that I'm doing right now is I've just gotten on board with helping a candidate who's running for Secretary of State. It's a statewide race. And this candidate hasn't announced yet, so I can't say their name, but they'll be announcing on October 4th. The point is that I'm on her staff as technical advisor, and we're going to be putting together a team to look at providing an open source solution to these and salvaging the investment that's been made, because we wasted $155 million of your tax dollars just to buy the machines in the first place, and we've since spent you know five times as much as we needed to every election since then to run our elections over what you can do with paper ballots to keep the machines in place. No, I do not at this time.
I don't recall the name of the organization that's been spearheading the effort in this country. However, they're out in California.
OpenVoting.org. OpenVoting.org.
There's also recently, I think, a PhD candidate student who has a challenge, tried to write the most concise code for voting possible, and ended up with something like three lines versus the, let me think here, 155,000.
There are a lot of issues that you have to address, though, that, you know, in fairness, is not going to be an easy thing. The language issues, the hearing impaired issues, the disabled community has been extremely vocal in making sure that these machines stay in place, because it is very empowering for a blind person for the first time ever to vote unassisted. The fact that whether or not their vote is ever counted correctly, you know, kind of gets slid under the rug, but it is a very empowering feeling to be able to go in and actually just put on a pair of headphones and vote without having someone have to assist you. Not if that printed out a paper ballot, you know. Yeah, they can't verify it any better than they could the audio ballot they're doing, but you know it's still a record, and they still have the autonomy of the actual balloting them, you know, independently. Right. that is where I expect my committee. That's where I expect my committee to take the direction I expect to take it.
I think you're kind of making the mistake of assuming that politicians would act rationally and with
forethought.
It's a serious issue. We've played the ropes at the Georgia Assembly together many hours, more than I can want to admit to, and it is a nightmare. Yeah,
collectively, thousands of hours. Trying to address this, and interestingly, we were perceived at first as individuals and as a group as an anti-democratic group that was doing this on behalf of the Republican Party. And at one point, a Republican state senator decided to take our issue on and put together a bill, but in retrospect, Tom Price ended up, it really seems that he was grandstanding to embarrass the Democratic Secretary of State.
Funny, he doesn't do that now that he's in the U.S. House.
Yeah, and I do wish, I've visited him and lobbied him in D.C. on this issue, and my feeling after speaking with him there that that his pushing the bill through the Georgia State Senate was pure politics. Unfortunately, he would not sign on to any of the federal bills trying to address this issue.
One of the things that hasn't come up yet is also that Georgia's not the first state to have, not the only state to have adopted these voting machines, but we are also not the first state to have decertified them. California has, North Carolina has decertified them.
Maryland has decertified them. Florida's decertified them. Just about every other state who has these machines decertified them now. So, we're going to be one of the last ones. We're going to be the last holdouts that hasn't junked these machines already.
Yeah, I believe there's 27 states that have banned this sort of technology, and we're the only state that has a statewide
zero evidence system. Electronic voting system.
But, go ahead.
With municipal elections coming up this year, and at least one huge election, the city of Atlanta election, draw 100,000 voters, what can we expect in terms of voting this November?
Well, what you can expect is that. And this is the biggest change, since we're talking about changes for 2008. The biggest change is the Republican Republican-controlled Assembly, has passed legislation that now allows you to vote by absentee paper ballot without any reason or excuse. So you don't have to perjure yourself and say, oh, yes, well, I can't get out of the house, I'm going to be out of the country then, or whatever. So without any, there's no excuse paper balloting.
Perjury is bad.
Yeah. Perjury is very bad, exactly. And the voting laws are very, very strict. There's a reason these companies don't want to have any accountability in their systems. It's because if there's accountability, people can go to prison for very long times, if they actually generate problems. You can vote on paper ballot. And the only thing is you just got to do it ahead of time. The Republican Party actually uses their tremendous advantage in the last election because every Republican on their lists received a paper ballot application in the mail so that they could apply for their paper absentee ballot and vote that way. You make it more convenient for people, The 7-Eleven store, I'll pay twice as much for the Slurpee, for the soda, but it's convenient. So they made it very convenient for all Republicans to vote by absentee paper ballot. And I actually got to count some of those when I was working as election monitor at Gwinnett in the last election. And I swore in because they were having trouble processing the paper ballots because of a flaw where the scanners couldn't read the original printed ballots properly. So they actually had 10,000 ballots that needed to be transcribed before they could run them through the scanners and count them, as opposed to counting them by hand, which would have been just as fast a process. But anyway, I counted a lot of them, and it was like 10 to 1. And I know that Gwinnett is heavily Republican territory, but not 10 to 1. But those paper ballots were coming in that way. Also, there's some questions here because paper ballots, we talked about chain of custody. Paper ballots or absentee ballots are not great for chain of custody because you're putting them in the mail and things like that. So at papercounts.org, I had very specific directions because you're allowed to take a absentee ballot into the registrar's office. You can't take it to your local precinct, but you can take it to the registrar's office. So the way I vote a paper ballot is I get it in the mail. I hold it securely until I'm ready to vote it, which I do on election day. I open up it on election day. I vote it. I take it down and deliver it by hand to my registrar's office, so there's no break in the chain of custody. And I know it's delivered the day of the election, where it's a lot harder to tamper with it after the fact.
So,
yeah.
We're kind of running out of time, so I was going to wrap up a little bit, which is that it's obvious that for the purpose of accountability and really for purpose of being tried and true, the paper ballot is by far the best system. Electronic is got its problems. It has some advantages, but the problems for a lot of people do outweigh those advantages. Hopefully, we'll come to a hybrid system like the print-on-demand we were talking about, where you get to harness a lot of the electronic advantages, but still do keep that chain of custody issue going.
And that evidence issue.
So, fire away.
Is there anything that might happen that would clear up some of the legal proceedings? If someone managed to hack one of these voting machines, how would that?
At this point, that's a two-part answer, unfortunately. At this point, the Garland case is there. Favorito is before the Supreme Court. They cannot add any new facts. Once you got a trial stage, no facts are allowed. No new facts are allowed. So Favorito is going to go down, whichever way it's going to go down, regardless. But new evidence is reason to bring a new lawsuit. And if there is legitimate proof of hacking or of the system, the machine is just flipping votes because they got programmed weird, then that will solve a whole lot of the problems that's in the Favorito case right now, and probably would lead to a reverse decision if the legislature didn't beat the courts to it as far as fixing it.
Of course, any actual evidence of hacking is virtually impossible to obtain because there's no forensic access to the systems. There's no third-party access to
it. It'd be a diebold guy with a conscience, most likely.
If someone managed to hack it so where it's obvious that there's something wrong, in a predominantly Republican-dominated state, every single vote is Democrat.
There was actually a case in Cobb County that was a smoking gun that really hasn't moved anywhere, and that was a tax initiative that happened some 2 to 3 years ago, where the tax initiative was the only thing on the ballot. Yet there were some 300 blank unvoted ballots. And for someone to go to the polling place and there's one thing on the ballot and to stare at the screen and then walk away without doing anything is really sort of beyond comprehension.
Are there corollaries to where that's happened, where there's been paper ballots, where there's been only one initiative, and has that happened or not happened?
I really can't speak to that. But speaking of other smoking guns, has anyone been following the Kentucky case from November 2008, where I believe at least three poll workers have been charged with actually rigging the machines?
No, I haven't seen that.
I haven't had a chance to follow through on that case.
Not surprising. If you haven't noticed, elections are getting a lot dirtier, it seems, the last, 10, 15 years. Yeah. Sorry.
Or do you think we just know more about
it? Yeah. I don't know. It seems like I'm hearing a lot more about it, but at my age is such that I was paying attention.
Well,
about 12 years ago.
There's been some major focus on it, but the transitions in these schemes to push to electronic voting, in my view, they're corporate welfare state problems. It's a problem of trying to privatize these basic public functions, and the self-interests of the corporation are not the self-interests of the public. They're usually in direct conflict. And because the interest of the corporation in protecting its assets and its shareholders and its profit margins is to strive to monopoly, which they've completely succeeded in here in Georgia, because no third party can compete fairly with them, because they control all the protocols. They control all the language of these machines. Nobody else can get into the machines and put software on them. Okay? So they strive to monopoly. Once they establish that monopoly, they can charge whatever they want, which is why it costs us five times as much to run our elections as it used to. Okay? The taxpayers are paying the corporate welfare tax. And, so these things need to return to basically the public holding. I'm going to finish up by saying that, you know, this Secretary of State's race that I talked about, it turns out that the Secretary of State pretty much has total autonomy in the, quote, certification, unquote, of the voting machines. And upon taking office, any Secretary of State could immediately decertify every voting system being used in the state and force the legislature's hand on coming up with a better system. This is why this upcoming Secretary of State's race is the most important race that this state has ever seen. The Secretary of State is a very powerful position. It is almost on a par with the governor as far as its autonomy. And the primary function of the Secretary of State, beyond licensing businesses and doing a bunch of licensing duties and things like that, is that they run the election process. And that's, you know, the constitutional state right here in Georgia. They're a constitutional position. So, get out there and vote, and vote paper ballot when you go. There's one other law that's come on the books now since the last time that actually allow you to vote paper ballot at your precinct. The hoop they make you jump through is you have to notify them a full week ahead of time that that's what you want to do. I want to vote on a paper ballot when I get to my precinct. So you can do it at the precinct at your normal voting place, but you got to jump through the hoop of just notifying them ahead of time, which is a little bit simpler and a better chain of custody than perhaps the doing it through an absentee ballot, unless you use my process, vote your absentee ballot, and then hand it in directly yourself to the county registrar's office.
I'd like to throw in a couple of points.
Sure.
I'd like the audience to take home. History of voting machine companies doing unethical things is really quite long. There are some good books on the subject out there. One's from the Avi Rubin. I'd like to bring your attention to at least two sort of corporate malfeasance issues with elections. One that was in the 2000 election is really well documented, where the Sequoia Corporation actually rigged the printing of the punch cards that were being delivered to Palm Beach County. That information didn't come out until the Dan Rather report series on HD.net came out. That's well documented in The Trouble with Touchscreens. Another incident of malice aforethought really goes back to the history of what has become Diebold Election Systems, and now is called Premier and soon will be called ESNS. Who actually has been doing the programming on these systems. That's well addressed in this documentary called Invisible Ballots, where they've investigated and found that the chief programmer at the GEMS Corporation, which became Diebold, he was a convicted embezzler, and he then acquired basically the majority of stock in the GEMS Corporation, and thus was the primary beneficiary of the first big sale of Diebold, which was to the state of Georgia.
At the time, the Georgia purchase was the largest single purchase of voting equipment ever made by a state.
And, the primary beneficiary would have been this convicted felon, and why he was sought out as to become the programmer for what was then the GEMS Corporation is a question that we may never know the answer to. Another sort of issue that I think really we'll never be able to make a legal case on it, but the design, there are so many design flaws in these systems that I, as a both a programmer and also someone who's worked in manufacturing, has personally come to the conclusion that these machines were designed to cause problems and to allow for no tracking of any manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But one last point I want to address is that if the voter GA case wins, then we'll be up against the same sort of corrupt legislative and lobbying process that brought these machines in the first place to the state of Georgia. And that is that our former Secretary of State, Democratic Secretary of State, Lewis Massey, he brought in his protege, Kathy Cox, to work as in a senior position in his Secretary of State office. When he left the Secretary of State's office, he then became a lobbyist for GEMS and subsequently Diebold. And thus, when he came back to sell this GEMS system to the Georgia legislature, he was basically lobbying his protege and ex-employee, Kathy Cox, and because Lewis Massey is actually the son of a lobbyist, as well as having worked as a lobbyist prior to becoming a legislator and Secretary of State, he is totally well-connected, and if we win on all the counts of the voter GA case with the Supreme Court, we will still be up against his lobbying firm, which has become much more powerful since this system was brought in. And the firm Massey and Bowers is very well connected, and we will be up against the same sort of lobbying dynamo that's brought us these, as I see it,
zero
designed,
evidence
designed for
defective by design is really what it comes to. Design is really what it comes down to, right?
System.
Yeah. Any voting system that doesn't produce evidence, to me, seems pretty much defective by design.
And so we will need a lot of citizen efforts and ideally angel donors, but you can't count on those to put in. Help us with professional lobbyists, and honestly, I think having people take time off from their workday, if at all possible, or send someone they know that's competent to lobby the legislature in Georgia or also in D.C. for the federal legislation that's now out there, is of primary importance in getting redress and retaking our democratic republic.
The only comment I would make is, you know, it was a stupid dispute about a flag that took down Roy Barnes. A stupid dispute about election machines.
Well, that's if the machines counted correctly, because actually the software was changed four times leading up to the election, and in a couple of cases it was only changed in Democratic counties without any certification.
The point being that political pressure is the one thing that a politician cannot ignore if it's loud enough and widespread enough. So to the extent this is something that concerns you a great deal, like it concerns people up here on the panel, that being loud is the surefire way to make sure something happens.
And my only follow-up to John's stuff is just to say, again, putting the bright person in the Secretary of State's seat is going to be critical. They can get around all this legislative political banter to a large extent. They can avoid these political pressures but because they really control the choice of the voting machine systems in the end of it. And the other thing that we're going to be working on as a campaign team and as a technical team is we're going to be putting together some solutions that will be attractive and affordable for the state, so that we can offer open solutions to these people when it comes time to change over if the suit wins.
I may have missed this, but isn't someone from the Secretary of State decertified all their systems?
That's at one point that happened in California, and then some a limited number of systems were recertified and some were not.
California also allows you to walk in and vote a paper ballot anytime at your precinct. So you can, you know, even if that were an option, were to become an actual option in Georgia without having to jump through any hoops, that would be a good measure to at least allow you the choice of having evidence of your vote and making sure that's counted. But again, if the ballot box is stuck in somebody's trunk, they break the chain of custody, they drag it off to the central office, they count it with scanners, and the scanners aren't audited, you don't have a manual check of whether or not the scanners are counting great, you're still in the same boat. And that's the way still most of the paper ballots get counted. So there's a long way to go to get back to just a simple, you know, counted in the precinct kind of paper ballot kind of system.
Okay. Question for you. Why is there so much opposition from the legislative branch? I mean, why would they be against more accountability? Because it goes straight to their credibility as elected.
Honestly, I do believe that Lewis Massey did a superb job of brainwashing the Democratic legislators, and the Republicans at the time that as Massey was trying to get this law passed so he could profit, they were in opposition to the system and. Maybe for purely partisan reasons, and in the meanwhile, though, the Democrats as a party in Georgia have never really embraced fully our position. A number of state legislators have. Roy Barnes, last time I spoke with him on this issue, was and still probably is completely convinced that he did the right thing when he applied legislative pressure as well to bring in electronic voting.
Yeah, two critical things happened though, John. That's the bait and switch that we discovered in talking
that's
to legislatures.
That's true.
Basically, there was a commission put together to approve the systems before they were evaluated and offered to the legislature, and that recommended in that recommendation, item number three is it must provide a paper record of the thing, and that was then the legislatures were told that these systems did that. Okay, because they supposedly take a snapshot of the screen, supposedly, and store that in memory inside, but that's never printed out, it's never put to paper, but that's their paper record, even though that's still processed by the software.
And actually, that's completely, despite the fact that we have videotaped testimony of Kathy Cox saying that the machines take this snapshot, it's technically not even true.
Oh, okay.
And, and in depositions for the voter GA case, that was laid clear. But going back to the dynamics on the other side of the aisle, the Democratic Party at the federal level basically got behind a bill from New Jersey Representative Rush Holt, who's a physicist, that would have addressed many of the election integrity community's concerns, not all of them. And there was bipartisan support, and it was expected to pass by a wide margin in the summer of 2008. And the morning of the votes, there was a letter that came out from the White House from President Bush asking people to vote against the bill, and I believe nearly all, maybe there may have been one or two exceptions of the Republicans who were co-sponsors of the bill, voted against the bill when it came to the House floor. Now, at that point, the House was actually a majority Democrat. However, the vote had been structured in an unusual way to require a two-thirds
majority.
Yeah. And actually the percentage that was voted was about 63%, and it's my opinion that the vote may have been structured this way because of the long-standing opposition to election integrity by Democratic Majority Leader Steny Hoyer. he has not been an ally of the election integrity movement.
Another issue is also this. Really, this only can matter in a lot of respects in a close race. If something just completely flips from a Democrat safe county to Republican votes, it would be noticeable. Almost all legislators are in safe districts, so they don't have to worry about it a whole lot, necessarily.
I think you're talking about the legislature and all this. I think your big fight after what happened in 2000 is if you go out on the street, 90% of the people you walk up to are going to think that the electronic voting is more accurate and a better record than the old.
Actually, that's not. When we do these polls in general public, and it doesn't matter which parties are prevalent, 75 to 90% are say, let's get paper ballots back. Do most people understand that the evidence has to be there.
Do you use those questions?
Is it there, or do you take a genuine survey?
Yeah, that's
those words are a bit weighted.
It's weighted, but it's accurate. It's entirely accurate.
Not at all.
Hang on.
It's a push pull.
How about last question,
and then we
disperse for the next panel because we're way over time. You're done? Okay. Then thanks all for coming out and for a spirited discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy the rest of the con.
All right.